TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein, No is Not Enough. Resisting Trump's shock politics and winning the world we need. This is the conclusion of a one-hour speech by Naomi Klein about her June 2017 book, No is Not Enough. It was specifically written as response to what she describes as Donald Trump's corporate political takeover. Naomi Klein is internationally known for her books, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, The Shock Doctrine, and No Logo. In spite of her scathing criticism, Naomi Klein writes with an empowering optimism. She says that Trump is making the need for systemic change seem much more obvious and appealing. The no to Trump, she says, may be what brings people into the streets, but the yes keeps us together into the future. Her new book, No is Not Enough, shows how to define that yes and what she calls the resurgence of the utopian imagination. Naomi Klein describes in detail the Canadian effort by 60 movement leaders and organizers to write the Leap Manifesto. They met for 2 days in September 2015. In what they admit were difficult negotiations, they agreed on 15 demands. They can be found on the website leapmanifesto.org. The award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, filmmaker, and author, Naomi Klein, was the keynote speaker at the Living Future Conference in Seattle, Washington, on March 19, 2017. Here's Naomi Klein.
We see this in a lot of social movements now that maybe sparked by a crisis, like cops killing black people, you know, or unlivable wages. But they are pairing their no's with transcendent yeses. And the movement for Black Lives is an incredible example of this. Last summer, in the middle of the election campaign, produced their own platform called the Vision for Black Lives, which if you haven't read it, you should look up Vision for Black Lives and read what is a blueprint for another world, another economy, which is not just about how do we get cops to stop shooting people, though it's about that too. It's about demilitarizing schools, it's about prison abolition, it's about a just tax code, it is about reparations for slavery and Jim Crow and other forms of systemic discrimination that translates into concrete policies like student loan forgiveness, free college education. And I would argue that we saw a resurgence of the utopian imagination in the way this country responded to Bernie Sanders. And I don't want to refight the last election and all of that, but I would just say that there has been such a focus on the outcome of that election and the horrific outcome of that election that we can lose sight of this seismic shift that happened on the progressive side, which is that we found out that progressive ideas, bold progressive ideas that we had been told for decades could never resonate with the American people are incredibly popular, especially with young people, right? So Bernie's out there, he's talking about free college tuition, forgiving student loans, universal public health care, 100% renewable energy by 2050, no new fossil fuel infrastructure, and the crowds are cheering. And he won 13 million votes, and he took 20 states. That is a very, very big deal. And it shows that if we do better next time and do better at building a broader progressive coalition that from day one convinces communities of color that this coalition understands that it is impossible to separate white supremacy from the history of capitalism, that this is not a project of just, well, we'll win on economics and everything else will be fixed in the trickle-down, our own version of trickle-down, that speaks to women and our understanding of the precariousness of the rights that have been won, that really weaves a coherent story of how all of these issues prop each other up. Because let me tell you, for Donald Trump, they understand that all of the attacks that they are waging are interconnected and part of a broader vision that they call making America great again, right? But so often, on the progressive side of the spectrum, we work in our silos, and we're afraid of making those connections. And that is part of the legacy of neoliberalism. We are afraid to speak in the language of ideology, big ideas, and that is the work that's going to move the center so that we can win reforms. You know, we often have these forces pitted against each other, like the people who are talking in sort of revolutionary terms are treated as enemies of concrete reforms, when in fact that is what creates space for those reforms. So we have some interesting ingredients shifting. Neoliberalism has been in crisis since the 2008 financial crisis, and everybody saw that you can break the rules for people if they're rich enough, right? We've been told there was no money for schools, no money for healthcare, no money for housing, but suddenly there are trillions of dollars to bail out the banks. You can't unlearn that once you see it, right? That was a very, very important moment. You have this rising of a utopian imagination, and yes, we have a shock. His name is Donald Trump. He shocks us every day. Now, I think it's complicated because I also think that the part of how we need to understand Donald Trump is that he's not, he's the least shocking outcome. He's a cliche in a way. I see him as living dystopian fiction in the sense that, you know, what dystopian fiction does is it takes current trends and it follows them to their logical conclusion, right? And then it holds up a mirror and says, do you like what you see? Because this is where all roads lead here, right? And so many of the roads that we have been on lead directly to Donald Trump, so directly that if you were a fiction editor at Random House, you would say, "This, I'm sorry, I can't publish this book. It's too obvious," you know? So I would say the advantage of this from a political organizing perspective is that Trump is making the need for systemic change seem much more obvious, much more appealing to large numbers of people. The shamelessness of his corporate coup. If titans of American industry can eagerly line up behind this man with all of his viciousness, venom, venality, vanity, and vacuousness, and if Wall Street can cheer on news of his plans to let the planet burn and the elderly starve, and if so many of our media outlets can praise his cruise missiles ordered over chocolate cake as presidential, well then a great many people are coming to the conclusion that they want no part of a system like that. With this elevation of the basest of figures to the most exalted of positions, this culture of maximum greed, individualism, self-interest is reaching a kind of a breaking point. And there is a growing understanding out there that it is the culture itself that has to be confronted now, and not policy by policy, but at the root. So things are shifting. They're shifting very, very quickly. We have some of the ingredients, the radical thought, the shock. Do we have the credible revolutionary threat yet? Well, we have more people getting involved in politics than, you know, any organizer who I know has ever seen in their lifetime, right? You have every march is exceeding all expectations for turnout, starting with the Women's March on Trump's first day on the job, right? It's pretty amazing. The March for Science, you know, tens of thousands of scientists standing up, yes. Sanctuary cities, sanctuary spaces of all kinds. People saying, no, we are going to stand up to the forces that would deport our neighbors, right? And people taking it upon themselves because they understand precisely that there are no protectors in officialdom, that it is up to us, and people acting like that. There is something healthy about that. There are the incredible movements standing up to new fossil fuel infrastructure. And, you know, very powerfully at Standing Rock, although ultimately at this point unsuccessfully, but that fight is not over. And in part thanks to cities like Seattle, which are going after the banks that are investing in projects like that, pulling $80 million have been pilled. $80 million and counting have been pilled from the banks that are financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. So this fight is far from over. As Seattle has been a leader in taking on fossil fuel infrastructure and new fossil fuel frontiers, right? Just because they're doing this in Washington does not mean that on the ground it is going to happen. And that is what Shell realized when they made the mistake of parking their Arctic drilling rig in this city for a little bit of maintenance when they were surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of kayaktivists led by indigenous communities, communities of color. They said no, and a few months later, Shell announced that it was pulling out of the Arctic for the foreseeable future. So I want to talk a little bit about an example of getting to yes. And I want to stress that there are lots of spaces in which this conversation is happening, where movements like the Movement for Black Lives, the Fight for 15, the Dreamers, the climate justice movement, the labor movement are coming together across differences to try to figure out what a common forward-looking agenda could look like. And it's hard, right? It's very hard because people are having to do so much at the same time. There are so many defensive battles that people have no choice but to engage in, right? Because we're fighting for our lives on so many different fronts, right? So there has to be a no. This is not about saying, well, we're only going to be about yes. No. We have a duty to say no when our neighbors are being deported, when communities are being criminalized. When pipelines are being pushed through indigenous communities without their consent. We have to say no, but at the same time, we understand that even if we were to win every one of these defensive battles, which we won't win all of them, then best case scenario, we're standing exactly where we were before Donald Trump was elected. And that is the ground that gave us Donald Trump. That ground is not safe. That's why these movements were rising before Donald Trump came along. So we need to do this complicated thing. We need to say no and yes. Maybe it's a sort of a Tai Chi move. we need to say no and yes simultaneously. We need to weave together our no and yes as twin strands of DNA. So I want to talk about an experience that we had in Canada about a year and a half ago where we tried to do this. We found ourselves in the middle of an election campaign, and we had a very right-wing government, Stephen Harper's government, and there was a huge amount of anger at this government that had been telling people that they had to choose between a healthy environment and a healthy economy. And Canada had become a complete climate renegade, but our economy was doing relatively well. So it was sort of this deal with the devil where everyone was sort of trying not to look at this giant hole at the center of our country that is the Alberta tar sands, okay? And then what happened is that the price of oil collapsed. It went from $100 a barrel to $50 a barrel in a period of 6 months, which is a shock. It is a very shocking event, especially for an economy that has bet the farm on fossil fuels. Not just fossil fuels, but a very expensive kind of fossil fuels. Because the tar sands aren't just very, very dirty. When you have to mine oil because it's in a semi-solid form, it costs a lot of money to do so. So it is no longer economically feasible when the price of oil goes to $50 or even $30 at its low. So more than 100,000 workers have been laid off in the Alberta tar sands. It has been absolutely devastating. And we found ourselves in this situation where we were told we had to choose between a healthy environment and a healthy economy, and we ended up with neither, right? So we decided to try to intervene in the election, because what we saw was that none of the major political parties that had a chance of unseating the conservatives had a platform that was in line with the climate science, that was connecting the dots between indigenous rights and the need for climate action and the need to fight inequality. These were being treated as separate issues. And so we had this gathering of 60 movement leaders and organizers, very interdisciplinary, cross-sectoral. We had the union representing workers in the Alberta tar sands, and we had Greenpeace, and we had some incredibly respected indigenous elders, and we had housing rights activists and food justice activists and migrant rights activists, and we sat together for 2 days. And it was really hard because we realized that we had no experience doing what we were trying to do. That we had come together in coalition before, but they had always been coalitions of the no, We had come together to say, we don't like this trade deal, or we don't like this government, or we don't like this very aggressive set of austerity policies. But we had not come together to say what we actually agree together we do want, to try to paint a picture of the future that we want. So we did that, and it was hard. There's a lot of difficult history between a lot of those movements in the room. We had a few ground rules. One was that no one is allowed to play "my crisis is bigger than your crisis," okay? Because, you know, if you are fighting for people to have roofs over their head, that is the crisis, you know? And there is this unfortunate history in parts of the environmental movement of sort of going like, well, first we'll save the planet and then we'll worry about all these other things, because if we don't save the planet, we're never gonna solve racism, or we're never gonna, and it's just like, whoa, that's how you a lot of people off, right? I wonder why this movement is so white, right? So we decided, no. We live in a time of integrated, overlapping crises. They are all urgent, and what we need are integrated solutions. We need solutions that radically bring down emissions, fight inequality, and begin to heal the wounds that date back to the founding of our countries. So my role in this was really just to listen. And we had all kinds of breakout exercises and all this, and you know, anybody who's interested in the process and wants to start a LEAP group in your community, go to leapmanifesto.org. We've got all kinds of resources there. You know, we had all of these spaces where we tried to draw out connections, and there were these very clear connections around living in an extractive economy. And usually that phrase just refers to resources, right? I mean, I think in a lot of the circles that you guys work in, that's as you shift from an extractive economy to a regenerative economy, a lot of the time we're talking just about our relationship with the earth, right? But what was really striking listening to people who were working on homelessness and migrant rights and mass incarceration and labor rights was that everybody was facing this culture of maximum extraction, as if there are no consequences. And it wasn't just about extracting from the earth, it was extracting from workers' bodies, it was extracting from communities, and cutting back as if there's no consequences, if there's no limit to taking, no limit to pushing, no consequences for those actions, right? And when we talked about the future that we wanted, this phrase of care kept coming up, that we wanted a culture of care and inclusion and cherishing, where everybody was valued, rather than this culture of extraction and disposal, right? You think about the extraction from the earth and the huge slag heaps of what the mining industry calls overburden, right? Well, people are also treated as overburdened and treated like garbage to be contained in jails, and we wanted to switch from that culture to a culture of caretaking for the earth and for each other. So we came up with this document called the LEAP Manifesto, And we chose the word LEAP because in Canada, people like to pride themselves on their sort of cautious centrism. You know, we don't get too excited. We're not like you Americans. And we kind of wanted to raise a defiant middle finger to that sort of cautious centrism that is so exquisitely dangerous in the context of the climate crisis. We do need to be bold, and we do need change on multiple fronts. We called it the LEAP also because when we wrote it and launched it, it was a leap year. And we liked the metaphor of a leap year, because if you think about what a leap year is, it is a rare admission that the human-created systems of measurement that we have do not sync up with the laws of nature, right? That our human-created calendars do not sync up with the Earth's revolution around the sun. And if we don't change our rules by tacking on a weird extra day every 4 years and confusing everybody, well, then we're in a world of pain. And it reinforces the fact that it is easier to change our human-created systems than to change the laws of nature, despite what almost all economists seem to believe. We called the centerpiece is energy democracy. It was very much inspired by the German energy transition, where as they have very rapidly shifted to renewable energy, on some days they're getting 50% of their power from renewables, and a lot of it is decentralized and community controlled and run. In hundreds of cities, they have taken back control over their energy grids from the private companies that were running them for profit, and they're now when there are excess profits from producing renewable energy, it stays in the community, and they're able to use it to pay for community services, daycares, and community centers. So it's fighting austerity, it's fighting climate change, and it's creating huge numbers of jobs. They've created 400,000 jobs in this energy transition. So we said that we want energy democracy, but we also said that we want energy justice and energy reparations, so that the communities that have been on the front lines of our toxic addiction to fossil fuels must be first in line to own and control their own renewable energy projects. And that is a basic principle. Front lines first. So there's, it's a really wide-ranging document. It also acknowledges the role that our own governments, and certainly your government's policies have played in driving migration, in pushing trade deals that are pushing people off of their lands, resource extraction that are pushing people off of their lands, accelerating climate change that is overlaying on top of conflicts and acting as an accelerant to war and driving migration. And so it calls for opening our borders to many more migrants and refugees and for all workers, regardless of status, to be protected by full and equal rights. The other thing we wanted to do is redefine what a climate job is. As you would expect from a document like this that is drawn in collaboration with trade unions, it calls for these huge investments in transit, efficiency, renewables. We know that we can create 6 to 8 times more jobs in these sectors than if we invest the same money in fossil fuels. And another core principle of the LEAP Manifesto is that no worker is left behind, so that the workers in the high-carbon economy are democratic participants in this transition, in their retraining. We've worked with, there's a group in the tar sands called Iron and Earth, which is workers in the tar sands who are demanding that they be retrained to become solar workers and, putting solar panels on schools, for starters, right? This should be a no-brainer. It's amazing that it isn't happening very, very quickly. So that was one of the core principles, but we also wanted to say, well, wait a minute, a green job, a low-carbon job, isn't just a guy in a hard hat putting up a solar panel. It is that, but daycare workers are low-carbon workers. Taking care of the elderly is low-carbon work. Teaching is low-carbon work. These are sectors that are overwhelmingly dominated by women, overwhelmingly dominated by women of color. This is some of the most undervalued work in our economy under relentless attack by the logic of austerity. So we said, these are climate jobs, and as we contract in the extractive sectors, we need massive expansion in the caring economy, because this is the work that improves tangibly the quality of life in our communities. It's expensive to do this kind of thing, which is why we worked with a fantastic team of progressive economists who came up with a companion document called We Can Afford to Leap. And, it's a good thing that we live in a time of unprecedented private wealth. We identified the logic of economic austerity as being at war with life on Earth. The money that we need for this transition is out there. We just have to have the courage to go after it. And these are a few of the ways. I think that last one, cuts to military spending, there's quite a bit of work to be done in this country. So the LEAP, the LEAP has 15 demands in all, everything from what a real progressive renegotiation of trade deals would look like, to calling for a debate about a guaranteed annual income, to getting money out of politics, electoral reform so every vote counts. And you can see why, since we launched the LEAP, there's been a lot of interest in this country for using it as a kind of a template for movements to come together in a common agenda, right? One thing we were very conscious of is that we didn't want it to just be a laundry list. We wanted it to be a different story about this shift from disposal to inclusion, from endless taking to caretaking, so that we're really connecting the dots with a new story about how all of our issues fit together, because there's not really any shortage of places you can go for a laundry list. But what we need are new stories. We've been amazed by the reaction to it. Tens of thousands of people in the country signed it during the election. And, a Canadian celebrity may sound like a bit of an oxymoron, but we have some. And, people like Neil Young and Arcade Fire and Ellen Page and all signed it. And Leonard Cohen, who is still alive, added his name. We were so happy. And it reminded me of this slogan that I first heard when I was in Argentina. during a very fractious election campaign, which was, "Our dreams don't fit on your ballots." And so people were voting, but they were saying, "Don't mistake our vote for a reflection of what we actually want. We're voting strategically. We're saying no to this government we need to get rid of, but this document represents the world we actually want," right? And so people were asking us for lawn signs and things like that. And I think it's, you know, I think in this moment in the US, it's really important to think about these models of people's platforms, of people coming together, not waiting for messianic political leaders to come along and do this for us, right? What we need are people who are the experts in the red lines in their communities, coming together, telling these stories, starting small at the city level, at the neighborhood level, spreading out to the state level, and there are discussions going on already at all of those levels in this country, and being very clear on what the vision is, so that when the next wave of politicians come forward to say, "We're the ones that are gonna take you to the promised land," the message is, slow down, here's our list, here's our vision, and our vision is going to lead, and you guys can follow. So just to wrap up here, no, and I think this is really important psychologically as well, because as I said, you know, we are seeing these unprecedented levels of engagement, but we're already starting to hear from people that they feel burnt out, that they feel tired. What is the plan? You know, the no, you know, no to Trump, no to racism, no to corporate malfeasance, that may be what initially brings people into the streets, you know, into their first political meeting of their lives, but it is the yes that will keep us together, engaged, dreaming, planning. The yes is the beacon in the coming storms, the light that will prevent us from losing our way. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour talk, No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, by Naomi Klein. She's the Canadian journalist, syndicated columnist, filmmaker, and author. Naomi Klein was the keynote speaker at the Living Future Conference in Seattle, Washington on March 19, 2017. Living Future is a forum for the green building movement. Thanks to Mike McCormick for the recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the electric grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.